TV Campfire Podcast.
I was like, yep, okay, so you win for the week.
We're here.
I hate to sound like a broken record.
Oh, no! We're fans.
It's one of the best things on television.
Oh! All right, we got you a hold of the
level. No, you didn't.
We talk TV.
That was the best scene ever. Like, that blew me away.
It was absolutely amazing. I just couldn't believe it.
Welcome to the show.
This is podcast number 609, and I'm Libya, your host. And this week we have returning guests.
Hi, this is Allison, and I write reviews for 6 Degrees of Geek.
Hi, this is Yusun, a costume designer and TV enthusiast from Los Angeles.
Hi, this is Tom. I chair visual and media arts at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida and host the Screen Tom podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Hello, this is Malik. I'm artistic director of Griot Theater.
All right. Thank you, brand new guests. And let's get started with the news.
Amazon has greenlit The Greatest, the first scripted series about Muhammad Ali. His widow, Lani Ali, is among the many executive producers, and Jalen Best from All-American Homecoming Season 2 will star as Ali. Spider-Noir has cast Lamorne Morris as Robbie Robertson, and he's going to star alongside Nicolas Cage. And Brendan Gleeson has been cast as a not-yet-disclosed villain. Michelle Yeoh and Hunter Schafer will be joined in Blade Runner 2099 by Dimitri Abeld from Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, and Lewis Gribben from Somewhere Boy, and 7 other people were cast in recurring guest roles. Emilia Clarke and Luke Evans have been cast in lead roles of the upcoming series adaptation of the criminal graphic novels. And to no one's surprise, at least not ours, Amazon has canceled Outer Range after 2 seasons.
Oh, God, that show sucked.
Thankfully. Mercy kill.
Euthanasia. Apple TV Plus has picked up Presumed Innocent for season 2 with a catch. It will be a new case, and Jake Gyllenhaal may or may not return depending on how season 1 ends. Maria Enos has joined For All Mankind season 5. She'll play Celia Boyd, a member of the Peacekeeper Security Force on Mars, and this will reunite her with Joel Kinnaman from The Killing. Jeremy Irons has been cast as Jennifer Aniston's father on the 4th season of The Morning Show. CBS has announced that Georgie and Mandy's first marriage will have guest stars Zoe Perry and Annie Potts in the first episode, and Regan Rivard, who plays Missy, will show up in episode 2. Hallmark is going to launch Hallmark Plus in fall with unscripted series, original movies, and their first ever holiday limited series. Yeah, whatever. A handful of Max originals are now going to be HBO originals. This includes Dune Prophecy, The Penguin, the Harry Potter TV show that nobody wants except for J.K. Rowling's agent, Welcome to Derry, the It prequel series, and Lanterns, the long-awaited Green Lanterns project. Euphoria Season 3 will begin production in January 25 with the entire main cast returning, because that's been all over the place in terms of what they were going to do. Hulu has announced that Halle Berry and Glenn Close will star alongside Kim Kardashian.
Wow.
I'm sorry. You laughing made me laugh.
I'm sorry. In the upcoming legal drama from Ryan Murphy, I guess he figured get some Oscar caliber talent for the two companies.
The Kardashians?
She's an attorney now.
That doesn't make her an actress.
I'm just saying she's an attorney now.
She's playing attorney on TV. The Max, the Pitt cast 9, including Issa Briones from Picard, Fiona Dury from Child's Play, the TV show, and Catherine Lanasa from Truth Be Told. Fun fact, evidently Warner's was mulling an ER revival and then ran afoul of Michael Crichton's estate. I guess they were trying to hold out for more money, and they're like, forget about it. We're just going to do our own new medical show with a bunch of ER vets and Noah Wiley. The Arkham Asylum project they were developing is dead. The animated Watchmen two-parter that will eventually end up on Max will be directed by Warner Brothers Animation veteran Brandon Vietti and adapted by one J. Michael Straczynski. The cast includes
Go back. Did you say JMS is doing a thing?
JMS is adapting the script, and basically he said, All the words are going to be Moors. I'm just getting it in the order for TV for a
Okay,
movie,
then.
which is good. So the cast includes Matthew Rhys as Night Owl, Katie Sackhoff as Silk Spectre, Titus Welliver as Rorschach, Michael Cerveris as Dr. Manhattan, and Troy Baker as Ozymandias. They did not say who's playing the comedian yet.
Good
Netflix announced
cast,
it.
though.
Say what?
Good cast, though.
Oh yeah, it's a great cast, but with JMS writing, I have faith, even
Yeah,
though
that's
it's
going to be
the third
fantastic.
time.
That's going to be fantastic. Yeah.
Julianne Moore, Millie Alcock, Megan Fahey, Kevin Bacon, and Glenn Howerton have been cast as leads in Netflix's upcoming limited black comedy series Sirens. Edward Blumel from My Lady Jane and Sex Education will join Mia McKenna-Bruce in Netflix's Agatha Christie series The Seven Dials Mystery. Simon Rex and Johanna Brady will recur in season two of Mo, and Rachel Bloom's one-woman musical comedy, Death, Let Me Do My Show, will be taped as a Netflix comedy special. At Paramount Plus, Richard Gere will join Michael Fassbender and Jeffrey Wright in the upcoming espionage thriller series, The Agency.
It's a
And we have
series
our
and not a
first.
movie. It's a
Say
series.
what? That is
It's a
a series.
okay. All right.
We have our first set of cadets for Starfleet Academy: Carice Brooks from The Prom and On My Block, Bella Shepherd from The Wolf Pack and The Wild, and George Hawkins, who graduated from London's Montague Academy of Theatre Arts just last year. And
Oh,
that
we faced it, but didn't they already say who's going to be the head of the academy? I thought that got
Holly
left.
Hunter is the lead, and
Right.
Paul Giamatti is going to recur as the season one villain.
Paul Giamatti's a good villain. I like it. Starfleet Academy, baby. How long is we've been waiting for that? That's been, I think, since the episode of with Wesley at the Academy, people have been asking for an Academy
Yeah,
TV show.
the rumor is it's going to be set in the Discovery far-flung future, not
That's a bad. I mean, you get away with, then you don't have to worry about
continuity.
continuity issues.
Yeah.
I see the advantage, but it's
And
not going
Tilly
to
can
be.
pop up from time to time.
There you go.
I know, but I don't know. I
Yeah.
get why they would do it in the far future, but I kind of want it in the not far future.
Yeah. Well, at least it's not baby Kirk, Spock, and McCoy like the original pitches were back in
Okay, yes, that's true. Okay, I wouldn't have wanted that either. All right, let's get started. Let's start talking about the shows. First up, we're going to talk Interview with a Vampire finale of season two, which was post the trial. And what I really, really liked about this episode is that it basically made you realize that Armand had literally been lying, not only for this entire season, but basically, what, like the last 100 years or
Hundred
something? The last
years.
77 years.
Yeah.
Insanity.
Who's counting?
Insanity. That, I mean, because we knew he was manipulating Louis. Like, they basically tell you he's been manipulating him all this time and screwing with his memory. But just the entire basis of their relationship is entirely based on a lie. Just kind of went.
Well, it's based on a lie and spite. I mean, that's
Yes, that's
basically
true
it.
too.
A
That is
lie
true.
and spite, you know?
Those
I
two
mean,
things are
that's
true.
not really the greatest basis of any relationship, I would think.
Yeah.
Worst boyfriend ever.
Oh my God. Like,
Wait.
just
What?
the whole, go ahead, Yusen, go ahead.
Oh yeah. Wait, but I'm confused though at this one, the when I mean it's pivotal, obviously. Where he is the one, he's not the one to have saved him, you know, and to have him say banishment. But why would he have wanted him to die? That's the part I didn't understand.
Because the whole thing is that Armand's a coward. Like, that's the whole basis of they had a relationship, and the coven came to Armand and said, it's either your life or Louis's life. And he picked himself. He was like, fine, I pick me. You guys can kill Louis. And so he had no intention of going out of his way to save Louis's life because he was trying to save his own. And then when Lestat actually saves Louis's life and Louis assumes that Armand did it, he just took the credit. He was like, oh
Okay,
yeah, I totally did that. Yes, but then help with me.
I think that there's also something to do with the fact that Armand is a control freak, and he could not completely control Louis. And I think once he realized that, it's like there was a part of him that kind of signed off. So he was okay with killing Louis, because, you know, and just moving on from there, because he didn't really want something that he could not control.
But then later he rescued him, though, right? But then later he rescued him, though, and took him out of the crypt and gave him his blood, right? Am I wrong about that?
He did do that, because at that point he has become such a pariah within the, even though he went along with it, he's such a pariah within the theater. I mean, he's lost all his authority to Santiago. So he's defaulting now to this, because maybe he can get some control back as a result of this. Now, you understand too that they went in a very different direction from the way it plays out in the book. So there are certain things that maybe are a little dodgy logic wise, but you can kind of fan wank it that way. but this is what I've, you know, kind of decided to go with as far as logic and motivation goes, where Armand is concerned.
Is that a technical term, fan wank?
It is.
Yes, it is. I can't take credit.
Fandom uses that a lot when something happens that doesn't quite make sense, but it works for what the fans want. So you just go along with it, because it's what you wanted anyway, even if it doesn't make complete sense. So you just go, yeah, that works, and then fan wank it. There you go.
Yeah.
But it just made Armand sort of diabolical. And then at the end, like why would you leave the reporter with Armand after he beats the crap out of Armand after he learns the secret, he learns all the information, he finds out the truth, beats the crap out of Armand, leaves the human fragile reporter in there with him and goes, don't touch him or I'll come for you later. And then, oh my God, surprise, he totally killed him. I was like, what?
Oh, but he turns him into a vampire.
He turns him.
But that still breaks the whole don't lay a finger on him or I'll come back.
Oh, Louis. Sometimes I think that these vampires let their hormones get override their common sense.
Yeah.
Because come
Only
on.
Sometimes.
Because Armand just, he's awful.
and
proving that Claudia and her late lover, and is it Madeline?
Yes, Madeline.
Their love was pure, because
they were for real.
They were willing to die for each other and literally go up in flames.
They were 100% together.
Committed.
But I did like how the episode ends with Louis just opening up his mind, and he's like, hey, if you want me, I'm here.
Bring it on!
He was just like, everyone's mad at him because he published this book and told all the vampire secrets, and everybody is like, you exposed us to humans and blah blah blah, and we're gonna come kill you. And he goes, oh, you're gonna come kill me? This is where I live, this is my address, bring it. And I was like, that's pretty cool.
But
I do like where they went with Louis as far as that's concerned, because one of the flaws in the book, one of the things that Louis is kind of noted for from the books, is that he's a weak character. That he's a pushover, and you know, he whines a lot and all of that. And they really eliminated that and made him a much stronger character by the end. And I thought that that works really, really well. So I'm looking forward to see where they take
this.
The
only problem is he's only like 100 years old, and they're vampires that are way stronger. So him doing that whole, this is where I live, come for me thing, I was like, I mean, he's a decent fighter. But Lestat showed him, Lestat's maybe what, 200 years older than him? Lestat handled him like he was nothing. Like nothing. And yeah. Oh my God. Who wants to talk about the conversation that Lestat and Louis had at the end? Like that was amazing. Nobody?
The thing is, that's in the book. That is from the book, except it goes in the exact 180 degree opposite way. In the book, he deliberately goes looking for a Lestat. He finds him in that condition, and he kind of just, you know, has a brief conversation. It's like, yeah, sure, you know, we'll get together again. We'll have coffee. It's terrific. Bye. And never sees him after that, except in later books, of course. But, you know, their relationship is over. And in this, they went in the exact opposite direction where they came together again as
soulmates.
It was
very good. Yeah.
And I loved actually the way they did it. You know, it's like not what I was expecting. And I appreciated that because now I don't know exactly where, despite the fact that there's all these other books, I don't know exactly where they're going to go because they're willing to make these kinds of changes. So, and the actors, of course, played it brilliantly.
They blew it out of the water. They were
absolutely
so good. They were so good.
I've got a question for Allison. How much will we theoretically see Louis in season 3, which is, I guess, starts Vampire Lestat?
I have no idea because in the Vampire Lestat, the book, Louis, I think, gets a paragraph. He's really just not in it. I think Lestat says, well, he lied about me, so here's the real story. And we get, you know, his whole origin and everything else and his time as a rock star and all of that. And Louis is like barely in it. But I think that they're going to probably change that because they're taking things from other books and they're willing to play around with the context.
And they really like those two. They know that the draw for the show is the two of them together.
They have tremendous chemistry. Their chemistry is amazing. So I think that that's going to be very different.
All right, I think we're going to wrap this up. I think we all thought this season 2 is superior to season 1.
Yes.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It didn't so suck good. And had a lot of bite.
Oh, wow. Wow. That was terrible, Tom, but thank you. But I think we're giving season 2 thumbs up. If you haven't watched it.
Or fangs down.
Fangs out. Fangs down. Fangs out.
Stop.
I love the joy with which he is saying these things.
All right. Next up, we're going to talk Star Wars Acolyte, episodes 6 and 7. And this is kind of like a weird downturn of this. Like, I was enjoying the show for the most part until these last two episodes.
Oh, seriously?
I was enjoying them, but now I kind of feel like.
So you weren't caught in the Sith thirst trap on the beach?
I did not get caught in the thirst trap.
Dude, no. I don't know if you saw some of the things, but people went crazy for.
I understand that. I'm talking from a story perspective, not from a hot guy coming out of the water perspective. So,
but that was the best part of the episode was the hot guy coming out of the water.
That was pretty much the best.
Because
I just was like, she wakes up. So this is not May. This is Osha. Osha wakes up. And some she's been kidnapped. She finds some clothes, gets a dagger, finds the dude who literally killed almost everyone she knows. And her first thought, because she's got this little tiny dagger, I was like, you can't kill this dude with that little dagger. What are you doing? So then she's like, oh, I found the lightsaber. She's like, okay, I can kill him with the lightsaber. I was like, great, this is a great plan. And then he gets out of the water and she's like, what lightsaber? Like, she just like loses her mind.
Realistically, we just saw in the previous episode we saw a bunch of experienced Jedi
get their butts.
We had two lightsabers get their butts handed to them.
Absolutely true. I totally
she didn't finish her training. There's no way she can take them on.
And I totally get that. But there's that moment where he literally puts the lightsaber at his own throat, and he's like, "All you gotta do is push the button to turn it on." I don't see how he could have stopped that, but. The whole thing is he's trying to seduce her to the dark side in like two different ways, like in the literal sense of seducing and in the, ooh, isn't this cool? I don't understand. And so she goes like, okay, I can't kill him. He's like, the ship's right there. You can just go. Why doesn't she even at least, I need to see her at least try to leave. Give me a reason why she stays on this planet with this dude.
This episode was not renowned for its logic.
Didn't make any sense.
The freaking beaver furry whatever creature figured out that May was not Osha before the Jedi did.
Yeah, but let's. I want Malik to talk for a second since he hasn't. This is intro.
Yes, I would frame this in a Princess Bride model, right? When they're about to attack the castle and say, "What are our assets and what are our liabilities?" The assets is that we're in a Star Wars war, Star Wars world, and we have lightsabers and force users, and we have this interesting twin story. The liabilities is that the writers are really not very imaginative and creative in terms of the story that they're telling. The story is rather predictable, and they want to get from A to B to C, and they're doing it rather inelegantly. So we knew that when they switched the twins, that there needed to be some journey for Osha to travel toward the dark side, or at least flirt with the dark side. So they knew that's where they wanted to go, but they didn't actually know how to write that in a convincing manner. So we know we're about to go there, and we're waiting for you to convince us that she really takes the journey. And they don't, she doesn't take the journey in the episode where it's supposed to happen. So now we're stuck at the end of the episode with her putting on the helmet, which is kind of cool, kind of a throwback to Darth Vader a little bit. So that piece is nice, but we don't believe how she got there.
Yes, that's trouble. Exactly. Exactly.
Soon to be available from Disney Consumer Products, by the way. Seriously.
Have your own helmet.
They put that up for pre-order like the day after that episode aired.
Oh my god.
Anyway, my
Malik pointed out this is an example of the difference between a story and a script. Your story may be interesting and solid, but the way you execute it, no, it's not good.
Yes. That was basically my issue with this episode. I don't believe Osha's journey. I do not believe that the character we just left in the last episode is the character that puts the helmet on. And I, off the top of my head, thought of dialogue that could fix this problem. And I was like, why didn't he say this? All he had to do was do this. All they had to do was do this to convince me of this. And they didn't do any of those things. And if I can come up with it, and I'm not a screenwriter, that's a problem.
You know, like what? I mean? Give the example.
All he had to do to convince her to stay on the island was tell her that he knew what happened to her mother or all the mothers. Mm-hmm. He's like, the reason right. the Jedi are really your enemy is because of this. I was there. I know this and this and this and this. And then she'd be like, oh, tell me more. And then
right.
that would have convinced me that she wouldn't leave.
Right.
He wasn't, I mean, in episode.
But I'm saying he could have, we don't know what he knows. He could have said a number of things.
He definitely knows the truth of what happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he wasn't there.
He could have just said that.
I got to say this. The biggest clue in that episode, which completely gets ignored in episode 7, is when during the thirst trap scene, when he's topless on the beach of the planet. Okay. Looks a lot like the one from The Last Jedi, by the way. And that was
I was confused. I thought it was.
That was intentional. But when you find out that the green-skinned, bald female Jedi Master uses a light whip.
Right, and he's got all those marks.
And he's got all the marks on his back,
That scar on his back looks like it was caused by a light whip. And then they didn't go anywhere in the episode. If you're going to do flashbacks, tell us something that we probably can't figure out by ourselves. But they just basically double down on... It's like what you saw before, but a little bit different.
I mean, they may eventually bring that up, but it you're right. I mean, it's something that we should have had given to us earlier. There's so much of this that's treated like it's a mystery, and this isn't a mystery. This this isn't a murder mystery or anything like that. There shouldn't be anything that's held off from the audience. You know, they're so caught up, I think, still on the surprise of Darth Vader being revealed as Luke's father, that they keep trying to want to recreate that moment.
I think
it's totally inappropriate. That's not what this story is about.
So they are trying to create mystery, but they're not handling it well. So presumably the mystery is what happened on that day when the witches were all killed and when May set the fire and all of that. And maybe secondarily, where did this Sith come from? So they have posited as a mystery, but they're just not handling it well in terms of what clues they drop and how they reveal what the answers to this mystery are. I think connected to that is a real problem with the Sith, which is his motivation keeps changing and is slightly blurry. Like, one, I want an apprentice, but two, I just want to be free and be able to be a Sith, but three, I know what happened and I want revenge. Like, his motivation flips
one.
And flops, right? And so we don't have anything to hold on to. I think I mentioned this to Libya, like in The Joker with Heath Ledger, when his motivation changed, it was interesting because that was the telling you something about the character. But here with the Sith's motivation changing, it's like they forgot what they wrote before.
He's kind of like a slacker Sith.
It's like, between drafts of the script, they forgot what it was that he was actually supposed to be motivated by it. And kept going. My problem with the mystery, though, is that this is a revenge drama. It doesn't need a mystery in it. And I think, I mean, they've obviously put a mystery in it, but I don't think it's necessary. We don't need the, what happened all those years ago
and
to be mysterious.
What would have been also interesting is the whole time I thought they were leading to a reveal that the downfall of the Jedi came from them being arrogant, came from them making some big mistakes and stuff like that. But then when they reveal what happened, it was just two young, impetuous Jedi who just made a mistake. And I was like,
oopsie.
I know. It's like, we killed all these people because we were impulsive. And I mean, it made Saul look bad. Like, I really made it made me
think, oh, he looks like an idiot. The other guy who just wants to go home because tired.
Yeah, that was
I mean,
interesting.
I was just,
if you're gonna do it, go all in, man. The Jedi gave the order to take those girls. The Jedi Council said take those girls by any means necessary, and that would have been interesting.
Yeah, but they didn't do it that way.
It also makes Anakin unexceptional. You got a whole line of Jedi who are impetuous and impulsive and can't control themselves. So it's like the fact that Anakin came around, it's like about time, because you guys are really poor teachers, really.
Yeah, I feel like they had the potential to make interesting choices and they dodged them and did safe choices instead. But the safe choices logically didn't make sense, because also if the council had given that order, it would have made the Sith's reaction to saying that the Jedi needed to be destroyed make way more sense. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just they're fumbling the story all over. But I'm done. We're done talking negative. Let's move on. So I think we're not giving these thumbs up. These are sides to dampish. No. For these
there
two
are
episodes.
Thumbs.
What did you say?
There are thumbs.
There are thumbs. All right, let's move on. Next up, we're going to talk Dark Matter, episode 5 and 6. And I know half of you have already finished Dark Matter and don't even remember what's going
on.
Oh,
good.
But I am taking it 2 episodes at a time so that we can discuss these episodes fully. And episode 5 is the episode where Jason, number one, and... God, what's the psychiatrist's name? What's her name?
Amanda.
Yes, Amanda. So it's them going from world to world, and he's finally figured out that his emotional state lets him get to find his family, except now he's close, but not no cigar. He keeps finding worlds with his family, but like they're dying from the plague or something else is happening, and so he can't...
Or he has a restraining order against himself.
Or he has a restraining order against his family, right. I have to say, though... When he gets to the world where there's a pandemic and everyone's dying and his son is upstairs dead in his bedroom and his wife is literally dying in the room, and Amanda's like, we can't go in there. We can't take whatever this virus is to another world. We can't expose ourselves to this. He's like, I can't let her die alone. She's still my wife. I was like, dude, what are you doing? And so this is the first time I've really been annoyed with him. Well, maybe... I also thought he should have left her in the frozen world, but I'm being slightly that one.
But yeah, going into the plague house was a little much. I kept expecting that to have a payoff later on. That was bad because, they kind of foreshadowed that in the earlier scene when we see, the other woman.
With the bugs.
The flying bugs. She destroyed an entire world by bringing them in. So I figured, oh, this is gonna have consequences, and then
that's the version from Jason B's world or Jason 2's world, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting, what you said there, Allison. I mean, they also set it up really well, like the military / first responders who intercepted them. The dialogue was great. The actors were great. They set the stakes really high. It was a really good setup for the danger of what they were stepping into. And then, you know, so we see him, I'm going to accept the danger because I really want to see my wife, even if it's this version of my wife. And then it doesn't go anywhere. So I agree with you. To have such a good setup with no payoff was a little disappointing.
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe in an earlier draft they went to another place and, you know, started spreading the plague, and then somehow they were able to cure it and move on. But the way it went here, where it really looked like something was going to happen as a result of him being careless, and then it doesn't. It was a little weird. Yeah.
But what the one payoff that did happen that's in the next episode is that Amanda realizes that she's just kind of a tag along and they're running out of ampules, and she has to figure out, what is she going to do? What does she want out of this? She's supporting him and helping him get home, but then she's going to be on a planet with two of her. What does that mean? Like, and she's starting to realize that her fate and his fate are not linked, because as soon as he finds his family, she's gone.
Is one of these episodes the one where she goes to a world where she's dead?
Disappeared, actually. She's not dead. Disappeared.
She disappeared.
I think you guys are ahead of me. I don't know what you're talking about. So the world that she saw was, she found one where she's married to somebody, they have a son, and she's way too close to them watching them. I was like, they can see you. she's just like sitting on a bench across the street from their house, just way out in the open. And I was like, what are you doing? But
well, don't you know people in TV shows don't have peripheral vision?
Apparently that was
nor do they look up.
Exactly.
Not trying to hide at all. But it's her seeing and then I think she also said she was a manager of White Castle on one of the planets. And they were having this philosophical discussion about, you know, kind of nature versus nurture. What changes you? What causes you to be that person in this world? So they were having that kind of conversation, which was really it was pretty cool. And then they had that moment in the bed where they were like, we can't do this. You should probably go to the other bed. And I was like, why are you guys in the same bed in the first place? Because I remember when it came on, I was like, isn't there two beds in this room? Why are they in the same bed?
I thought that was, I mean, I kind of liked that tension. I liked the tension and I liked how they resolved it. And that it didn't end up being kind of the trope of, we shouldn't be doing this, and then they do it anyway. So it was like, we shouldn't be doing it. And she actually gets up and goes away.
Right.
That was a refreshing change from the trope.
Yes.
Yeah. I was going to say something to your earlier point, Libya, about her figuring out where her place is. So the character Blair that they found actually said that to her. She told her, you're going to have to decide what's right for you.
Because
Amanda can't go back to her own world. So she will ultimately be in some world that's not hers. One thing that I found interesting is that they kind of left the idea. Originally, they talked about the idea that, yes, your mind state affects where you go. But also importantly, when there are two people, both of their mindsets affect where you go. And they've kind of let that go slip away. So when Jason is getting close to his home, they keep focusing on what his thoughts are. But they don't talk about the fact that Amanda is with him every time he opens the door.
And I don't think she necessarily wants him to get home, too.
Because if he finds the right home, she is like officially out of place.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that those two things together are at least, because I don't know what happens in the next episode. So that's where I'm at right now. And the episode ends with Jason, too, by the way, such a douchebag. Oh, my God, I hate him.
Dranding Ryan.
So he basically takes his friend figures out that, you know, you've stolen my formula. What the heck did you do? And he's like, how'd you get this ampule? And then he's lying. And I was like, is he going to murder? Like, the whole time they're talking, I was like, is he going to murder his friend? And then he's like, I'll show you. And I was like, why is he showing him this? And I was like, is he going to take him there and just murder it? And I was like, oh no, he's going to take him there and just leave him. And that's
exactly abandon him like a puppy.
Yes.
Well, but,
on the side of the road.
In terms of moral equivalent, that's not any worse than what he did in the season premiere, right?
No, it's not. Like I said, he's a douchebag. Like, I
will say that the world that he brought him to, and this kind of ties in with his own view of himself, because he doesn't see himself as a bad guy. Right. He brings him to a world that's pretty good, you know, right. And it's, you know, ostensibly so he can look and see how wonderful this place is, but also because he thinks, okay, well, if I have to abandon this guy because he's become, you know, a problem to me,
a liability,
I'm gonna bring him to a place where he'll thrive.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's not just gonna, you know, abandon him to some place that's terrible. So in his mind, he's done a good thing. He's been responsible.
But the thing that's crazy is when he's talking to, because he sees Amanda as a psychiatrist, which is also weird. So he sees Amanda, he tells her, like, I can't make my wife happy. I'm da 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 da. And he's like, she's like, it sounds to me like you have commitment issues. He's like, I've been married for 15 years. She's like, you don't sound like you've been married for 15 years. And I was like,
that was nice.
I was like, yeah, you're a psychiatrist for real. I thought that was good.
The series kind of does well is the fact that you may think you want to relive this choice you made, you know, the two roads that diverged in the yellow wood that Robert Frost wrote about, but you're still the same person.
Yep.
And the choices you made shaped you, and you can be put in the trappings of this, you know, idealized situation, but you're still not the person who nurtured that version.
Right. So he doesn't understand his wife at all.
At all.
At all. And I love that comment where, like, he just humiliated her in front of all her artist friends. And he's like, I thought this would make you happy. And she goes, no, you thought it would make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, there you go.
Snap. You go.
And I was like, that was, and the fact that he couldn't, he genuinely did not understand why she was upset. Like, that boggled my mind. I was like,
he's a dumbass about relationships.
Well, but that's, it's his fantasy. You know, if you go back and ask yourself, you know, why did he do this in the first place?
Right.
Outside of him being a scientist who wants to discover all kinds of things, he specifically found that world because he has a fantasy of being with the woman that he let go. So she's not a real person to him. She's this fantasy of the life that he could have.
Yeah, okay. I like that.
And also, I think, you know, the difference between the two iterations of him is that he is the version, Jason 2 is the version that made selfish decisions. He was all about himself, and he's spent a lifetime continuing down that road of making selfish decisions. And the other Jason, the first Jason, is the one who set himself aside and made decisions that were good for the woman he was in love with and good for the child who was going to be coming. And he has been continuing to put himself second or third for his whole life in order to have this family that is very, very important to him. So I think that's the difference between how the two have grown is one is selfish and the other one is to a great degree selfless.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And,
nailed it.
And I think that's the thing why I now, when we switch to Jason 2, I get super irritated. Like, I don't want to spend time with him. I do not
like he's a terrible person.
Yes. I do not like this dude. And I'm like, every time when you hear that snap, and that means we switched worlds, I'm like, nah.
Oh.
I'm like, oh, I hate this guy. All right, that's enough talking about that, but I'm loving this show. How about that? The show is working really well. All right, let's move on. Next up, we're going to talk about The Boys, and we're going to talk about episodes 6 and 7. And oh my God, episode six. I literally fast forwarded during parts of that basement, in the basement scene where they were in the
torture,
second dungeon.
Tech Knight's House of Horrors.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I genuinely, once I realized how dark this was going to go, I was like, I don't need this in my brain.
Well,
like,
considering you like, have the old sidekick chained up in some kind of bondage outfit.
I want to know
with
who
a
was
ball
underneath.
Gag
I kept
in
thinking
his
that
mouth.
Was like
yeah.
a cameo. I feel like that's a cameo actor who was underneath that mask. But
I kept wanting to know who was underneath.
Yeah,
that,
I
want to
know who's underneath.
And they
the
never
mask,
showed us.
But I just, it was so, it got darker than I'm even comfortable with. I mean, to be fair, The Boys gets dark in a way that I'm not necessarily comfortable with anyway. But this one, I was like, I don't need this. This is not something I need in my life. So I genuinely just, there was about 5-10 minutes that I was just like, I'd skip forward. I was like, oh, nope, skip forward again.
Skip again.
It was bad. But the actual story, let's just talk about the story, which is Homelander and his team of Supes are planning a coup. Like they're planning to assassinate the president. And the vice president is a Soup, and they want her to be in charge and enact all this stuff. And so they're at a meeting with the richest people in the country to get on board with their coup. And they're selling them on the plan. And the most hilarious thing happens, which is Sage.
Sister Sage.
Shot in the head. So she has brain damage. And so she's the one who came up with the plan. And she's sitting in the corner eating cake. It was I was just like.
And getting most of it on her face. Yes.
It was hilarious because Homelander, as much as he likes to think that he's in charge and he's the boss, when it was time to explain the plan, he couldn't explain the plan because he didn't know that he's not.
He didn't
smart.
Understand the plan.
He is not a smart man. And so then when he tried to like fake it and articulate it, they were like, we're not the stupid masses. Like, cause they're all the millionaires, the billionaires. They were like, we're not the stupid masses. You can't sell us on Antifa crap. We want to know the actual plan. And then he was like, and he had nothing. And he got saved by the vice president.
Victoria to the rescue.
Who's also a woman who he's such a misogynist too. So also a woman who finally was like, oh my God, this idiot. And so she stands up and articulates the actual plan because she actually understands it. And then he's like, Sage humiliated him and he acted like she got shot in the head on purpose. You know, like he's like the next meeting they have, he's all mad at her. And I'm like, dude, someone shot her in the head. Like,
yeah, but that's not how he
alive. Like, what do you?
That's not how he processes information.
He's mad at Firecracker for being ineffectual and for getting attacked.
Well, to be fair, Firecracker is ineffectual and is an idiot. So
but
I feel like that's
yeah, but he put her in that position too. You know, the thing is, he filters everything through this ego. Thing of how it affects him.
Right.
He doesn't care how it affects other people. I mean, the fact that Sage got shot in the head, yes, he blames her because it made him look bad.
Right.
And that's the only thing that he actually cares about.
Of course, the reveal that Firecracker, he's getting ready, you know, as much as I loathe the character, you got to give the actress props from he could have done some violence to her and she totally flips the situation and says, I'm your number one fan and I know what you need.
Oh my God. The thing that I have to say, I saw an interview with Anthony Starr when he talked about that scene. He talked about the fact that on paper, it was just written as, you know, she squirts the milk on him and then he does a weird breastfeeding thing. And he's like, yeah, that's just an episode of The Boys. But he said when they were actually shooting the scene, he got hit in the face with the almond milk that they sprayed at him. He said that he had a really visceral emotional response. And he was just in a really emotional place. It just went there. And the actress just went with him and it became like this weird kind of love scene. It's not like a sex scene, but like he fell in love with her in that moment. Well, and he was just like, it just flowed in them doing the scene, which I thought was kind of cool. I thought because I actually was slightly, even though I was grossed out, I was still slightly like, oh, this is interesting. So, yeah.
It reminded me of that vamp from Roxy in Chicago where she says, you love me and I love you because none of us got enough love when we were children. And that's showbiz. She's damaged. He's really damaged. But she knows what he wants and she knows it will bond her to him.
Right.
And is that like an open secret in the boys' world?
True. Everybody knows that. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, ew. But I got to say, she turned around that volatile situation.
Yeah, she really did.
To the next episode.
Oh, you know, my God. The thing that I loved is when he fires Sage, right? Because I can't remember why he finally fires her. Why did Homelander finally
because fire of the whole being
because
shot
of the
in the
whole
head
kerfuffle
thing
at the
fire. No. That's why he demoted her. He demoted her and said Firecracker is.
When he found out that the wrong person was.
Oh,
right.
So he just killed
being Malik. Yeah.
Right. That A-Train is actually
A-Train is the real Leak.
Yeah.
No, I actually was impressed. He was crying. He was crying because he really believed that A-Train was his friend. And he found out that A-Train wasn't really his friend, and he was sitting there crying like a little baby.
Did he cry like Doctor Who?
Oh.
Nobody cries like Doctor Who.
Little tear.
Oh, that's dirty. That's dirty. But yeah, he actually was crying. Like, you never see that dude cry, but he was crying because he genuinely thought that A-Train was his friend, and to find out that A-Train hates him and betrayed him just really hurt his feelings. And he was sitting there in his feelings like, she's like, I can help you. And he's like, nope, I'm not in the mood for that either. I'm just going to sit here. And he fires Sage, and Sage goes down the hall. And Noir was like, but I love you. And then you find out that
and both
Deep
the
and Noir
out.
are, she's doing
he's
the same thing
with
both
of
them.
And it was
she's got to have it.
And what was great is, the Deep, she has to get herself like brain damaged to sleep with the Deep, but she doesn't with Noir. And I was and then the fact that the Deep like literally killed his
octopus
girlfriend for Sage, because he was like, I'd rather be with Sage than my octopus girlfriend, which that's a whole different
he killed Tilda Swinton.
But then he finds out that she was sleeping with other people and she had no feelings for him at all. Like, they both were like, oh my God, we love you. And she's just like, peace. And she just keeps walking out. I think that Homelander needs to be afraid, mainly because he is she anticipated him betraying her. Like, I'm sure she anticipated it, but I think she figured it was a couple of steps further. But he doesn't know what she's going to do. You know what I'm saying? She's not going to go back to her closet apartment and wherever she was living. She's in the middle of an assassination plot. She's got her fingers in too many pies for her to just go home. That's not happening.
Oh, yeah. So
that is not happening. And he should be really concerned. And he's not. I was like,
because he's too arrogant to be concerned.
He is. I mean, he just turned on the smartest woman. No, excuse me. The smartest person in the world. He just turned on her and thinks she's just gonna sulk. But no, dude, no. You've given her a taste. You've given her a taste of power, and she wants it all. So, yeah, that's not gonna end well for him.
And occasional booty calls with other heroes.
Yeah.
And other thing that happened in the episode is that we did get the reveal that we discussed before of his little head friend being nothing but his little head friend,
which
Butcher.
Jeffrey
Dean Morgan.
I like that Jeffrey Dean Morgan was like, you're not the only one who can give you the silent treatment, when he wasn't like helping him out. And because that fight with the deep Noir, and I didn't realize that was Starlight was that strong.
Oh yeah.
Like, they were just throwing punches like Superman fighting Superman. It was pretty awesome. And but that was a good fight. Like, I felt like Homelander didn't send enough people. Like, you know, you're going to go send people to kill Butcher and the boys. The boys genuinely started by killing superheroes. That's how they started. So you're going to send, I mean, to be fair, Noir is pretty big. Like, okay, sure. Noir is pretty big to send, but they still only sent two to kill all of them. And only two of them. You mean he was only supposed to kill Butcher?
No, but no, they revealed that Noir can fly.
Right, because it's a different Noir.
Different Noir, yeah.
So it sounds like on this one there were thumbs as well.
I really liked this episode, other than the gross factor of the sex dungeon. The sex dungeon should have just been a
and
lot.
And Web Weaver's interrogation story.
Oh, God.
I couldn't hear what Tom was saying over everyone's reactions.
I could have lived my whole life without seeing that.
During the interrogation, he keeps squirting web liquid out of his web hole,
which is basically his butthole.
I hate when that happens.
It's above his butthole, but before Homelander literally rips him apart.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's a completely gross scene.
NSFW. And
the boys have been getting a lot of pushback, a lot of flack about, you know, how they've really upped the ante in terms of gross out this particular season. And they have, you know.
Oh, my God. It was some of that is unnecessary. Like, you can insinuate. I don't need to see it all. Like, I don't
it's
need
all about
of
the viscera.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on.
Oh, don't forget that Huey gets thinks he's having consensual sex with Starlight, and she's been replaced by a shapeshifter.
Yes, and then we find out Starlight is chained up in a basement somewhere, which is also
That's actually like Dark Matter then.
Someone's
in
chained
the first
up in a
episode,
basement?
She thinks she's having sex with her husband.
Oh,
no.
She's
having
okay.
sex
I was
with
like,
a stranger.
I thought the sci-fi shows were doing it. Someone chained up in a basement. Yes, okay, yes. That is similar.
Basement, alternate reality, whatever.
All right, next up, you guys very quickly sum up Bridgerton. Go!
Oh, the last two episodes, Portia, is that her name? Portia tries to blackmail Penelope, you know, and keeps raising
Are
the
you
price.
Talking about Featherington?
Say what?
It's Prudence, isn't it?
No, Penelope.
Penelope.
Oh, I'm sorry, Portia. Okay,
oh, wait, no,
I'm
the
sorry.
One who wants, the one who wants to pretend that
I'm
she's,
thinking of the
she's
wrong
lady.
Sister.
The one, not it's not the sister. The one who wants to. Are you talking about the one who wants to convince everyone she's Lady Whistledown?
Yeah, is that Portia or Prudence?
Neither. I'm blanking on her name though.
Oh, anyway,
I know it's not one of those.
anyway, she
really know Bridgerton.
We've really gotten off to a great start.
It was so long ago.
But I know.
Anyway, that forces Penn's hand that she has to out herself because they don't want to play this ransom, which keeps increasing. And then, but the way she does it is so elegant in front of the queen. And basically the queen kind of gives her a pass and says, we shall see if you can live up to it, which I thought was a nice elegant thing. And then of course we had the stakes of, will Colin ever be able to forgive her for his betrayal? Blah, blah. And of course he is.
Oh, Cressida Cowper. That's the one you're referring
yes.
to.
Cressida.
You know, all in all, I thought it was a really satisfying season. It was good to see Penelope kind of front and center, even though sometimes I'm like, you can do better than him because he's kind of a himbo. Every once in a while he'd show flashes of integrity and whatnot. But I think the thing that kind of bonded them was the both love to write. But we get the flash forward, and to no one's surprise, her idiot sisters both have girls. And she produces a male heir to the Featherington fortune.
Of course. I really like this season. I think, you know, my interest in Bridgerton is entirely on whether I'm interested in this particular character or this particular couple. And last season, I was so not.
Yawn.
I mean, it was.
Well,
it was just a
gender flip of the first season.
That's really all it was, and it was really boring. It was really boring. But, you know, I am very invested in Penelope. And so what happens to her and all of that is important.
One thing I have to say is the whole reveal of her being Mrs. Whistledown. Is that Penelope?
Lady Whistledown.
Lady Whistledown. I thought that was a bad reveal. Like, I didn't believe it. I like they built up Miss
Oh, I thought
Whistledown
you
to.
didn't see it.
I saw season one, and I
No,
saw
but I'm
part of
saying
season
this
two.
season
I
is the
have not
reveal.
seen this season, but I'm
Well,
telling
that's the
you.
reveal.
No, they reveal it earlier. They reveal
No,
it in season
my
two.
even
to
my
the
under
audience.
She's revealed to the audience
Is
as
that you're
being
talking about
Lady
to the
Whistledown
audience?
in season
Yeah.
one.
In season one, it's
The end
revealed
of
to
season
us that
one, we
she's
know
Mrs.
about that.
Whistledown, and I just did not
But
buy
she doesn't
it. Like,
come
I did
out
not
to
believe
everyone
it.
else until this season. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a big reveal, Olivia, in this season where she reveals herself to everyone, which is actually pretty iconic. I thought it was incredible.
It was a
I
good
have to
moment.
say, I was, I kept going through this whole thing wondering how in the world is she going to reveal this without, ruining the whole Lady Whistledown thing for the narrative purposes, number one. And how is she going to manage to reveal this without having everyone hate her as a result? And they managed to do it. They actually
I
handled
thought the
it really
solution was
well.
very elegant and the actors pulled it off. My understanding is, I guess in the books, the reveal doesn't happen until much later. I would suspect in book three, since this season was based on book four.
Yeah.
So, but they decided, move it up into the end of season one for the viewers. But if season four is interesting, I'll watch it. If I like the pairing, I will.
So,
And if I don't, I won't.
well, going along with that, I mean, I was curious how they were going to keep the queen interesting,
Oh, the queen's
right?
awesome.
She is,
She's a
but
baller.
it was her trying to uncover it actively and taking steps she had not been willing to take before. And she ultimately forces, in some ways, she forces the reveal. So I love that payoff of the queen's involvement and Penelope kind of running out of choices and having to confess in front of the queen and the rest of the court. So I thought that was beautiful. What I don't know is how they're going to keep the queen interesting in the next season. Because that had kind of been her motivation. So we'll have to go
I
ahead.
think that there's more to the queen than just trying to find out who Lady Whistledown is. I mean, I loved the series that they did on just her character.
Yeah, that was
I
really
thought I
Oh,
actually enjoyed that better than Bridgerton, to
I
be
did too.
honest with
Yeah,
you.
it's
So
amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
I would love if they did a sequel to that and we just got more of the queen, because
What, Queen
she's a
Charlotte?
terrific character.
Yeah,
Yeah,
she was. I
she's
loved Queen
terrific.
Charlotte. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Great
All right.
character, great actor.
Let's wrap that up. We're saying, you guys saying thumbs up?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Thumbs
Oh,
up.
yeah.
All right. Next up, we're going to talk about Sunny. And this is, we're going to talk the first two episodes that got dropped on Apple. And it's the premise is that it's Rashida Jones in Kyoto, Japan. And it opens with her husband and her son have been in a plane crash. And she's sitting there talking to the plane rep. And it's really about the fact that the way she expresses grief as an American versus the way the Japanese express grief is very different. And it's a big cultural divide. And their solution is to give her this robot that's supposed to be her companion. And she's like, this is creepy. Why would I want a robot? Like, and but then it unveils another layer very quickly, which is her husband has been lying to her this whole time.
Well, there's also, before you get to that, it's
Okay, what?
revealed very early that a robot kills someone and
Yeah,
then it's covered
we get a
up.
cold open of that.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's
Yeah.
pretty important. So not
This
only does
show
she think it's
understands
creepy.
mystery.
Yes.
I mean, when I first saw that, I thought that it was her husband who was the victim.
Yeah.
And later on they show another shot and you realize it's not him. But I mean, it what was interesting is that in Japanese, he's yelling, "I love you, I love you." Meantime, he's getting beaten to death by a chair, wielded by a homicidal robot. And then we move, to her, and she's dealing with supposedly the death of her husband and her young son in a plane crash. And from the very beginning, we're off kilter with this, which I really kind of like, because you're just questioning from the very beginning which part of this is, or any of this, is real. I mean, her husband was clearly lying to her, but there's something going on with her mother-in-law as well.
Her mother-in-law
is beyond strange. She does not behave like any grieving mommy that I've ever
seen. She obviously knows her son's not dead.
Well, there you go, Olivia.
I think it goes beyond that because remember, she's not only
flashbacks with mommy dearest.
Seriously. Yeah. I mean, because not only is she having parties in her house, but she's taken down pictures that he did as a child that she used to have on her wall. Like, oh, I don't need that anymore. You know, like that's something I don't need to pretend at. And so I think it goes beyond just knowing that he's not dead because, you know, that I think she leaves stuff like that. But she's taken things like pictures down. And that just doesn't make sense to me if she's really, I mean, it's like, is she his mom? Is she someone just playing his mom? What exactly is going on?
But Rashida Jones would know what the mom looks like, I would hope.
Yeah, well,
she knows what the woman looks like who's been introduced to her, but he's been lying since the beginning, so why not lie about who his mother is?
I think it's interesting, the whole thing about him not being dead, right? There are multiple characters who refer to him in the present tense after they presumably believe he's dead, right?
Right.
The people from work do that. Yes. There's like at least two or three characters who refer to him in the present tense, even though he's supposed to be dead.
And then they figure out that she's the wife and they go, oh yeah, he's dead. Right. Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
And they also refer to him in terms of someone who they need to be afraid of.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that made an impression too. But yeah, there's weird, weird stuff going on. And of course the robot she's been given was presumably programmed by her husband, but doesn't remember anything prior to being activated for her until at the end, you know, she starts getting little flashes. It's you just don't know at this point what's going on. And that's kind of fascinating.
I thought the way episode one, the pilot ended with the robot doing the same kissing goodbye kiss.
Oh yeah.
That was really interesting, especially
when it was creepy too. It was like, whoa.
And creepy. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, where she wants to throw it overboard, over the bridge, and she can't pick it up. So she just abandons it like an AI, except for it, you know, comes back home.
Yeah. I'm mad though that she didn't. Well, before I say what I'm mad at. So we talked earlier about the fact that she was creeped out. Well, so that we start with the robot killing someone. She's generally creeped out by a robot. And then by the end of episode two, we're talking about episode two now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of episode two, we realize that that robot is the robot that committed the murder. So I think that's a nice journey to go on just even in the first two episodes. I'm mad that when the bartender, Nixie, told her, oh, I turned mine all the way off, she didn't ask the obvious question of, oh,
how do
you do that? Like, that was clearly the next question.
Also, the bartender used the robot for sex, which was like, ew.
Hey, you gotta get it where you can, man. But
go ahead.
She didn't ask the obvious question because she wants to turn it off. And she doesn't say, oh, how do you do that? Which, that was a little bit of a hole for me. But I think what also I love the fact that they were not afraid to have so much of the dialogue in Japanese. I love that. I know in general television shows are more bold because of international audiences, but they used to be afraid that Americans wouldn't watch if something is in another language. And here they were like,
Apple TV Plus, they're paying a premium anyway, so they might as well do some reading.
So I love the fact that so much of the dialogue is in Japanese. I will have to say, on the downside, I loved Rashida Jones in Parks and Rec. I do not love her in this. I love every other actor, every single other actor in the show, but her. I don't.
I like her in here.
Yeah. I don't think she, whether it's her or the writing, she, in her scenes, I don't get the tone of the show. And every other scene, I get the tone. I get what it's trying to be. But when she's in center of the scenes, I don't. I think the tone is confusing, and I think it's because of her performance.
I think it's the direction, really, because one of the things that struck out that stuck out to me, you know, when we see her at the beginning, she's miserable and she's sarcastic and she's angry, and all of that works, you know, because she's in the stages of grief. But then we see her in a flashback, and she's the same way. And it's like, is that your one emotion?
No, I think the flashbacks are not true flashbacks. It's memories, because she's responding to her husband like she would now. So it's not a genuine flashback.
It does, because she does turn out and she says things out loud, like when she looks at her kids' shoes, it's like, oh, yellow. You know, things like that. It's herself viewing herself. But even
the flashbacks in the second episode with her husband, she's saying things to him that she didn't say originally.
Yeah, because in her head. But even in her head, I mean, okay, maybe she sees herself as dour, but it doesn't work for the audience. You need to see her that, oh, she was different when things were better.
Oh, I see what you
instead
mean.
Of just constantly, it's like, otherwise you think, oh, she's just a miserable person. Why do I care about her?
But also she talks about the fact that when she came to Japan specifically running away and to be alone, and her husband surprised her and made her want to be with him. So she was not a happy person in the first place.
I don't think the request is that she has to be happy. The question is, how is she different, right? If she's experienced grief, how is she different before? It doesn't mean just happy has to be the difference. But I also think that if she found a difference, it would help those flashbacks, because we would know, oh, this is essentially what actually happened, and here's the moment that the current version is interjecting into the scene. Yeah. I think we're to assume that most of the flashback is more or less what happened, and then there's these moments where she bumps against it to say something she didn't say or observe something she didn't observe.
Right.
So if her character were slightly different, it would help to tell that story.
Yeah,
but I agree with Allison. That's probably a directing problem, because Rashida Jones is an actor. We've seen enough of her in other projects. But I think that's one of the issues, is the show can't quite decide what genre it's in.
Yeah, because I was like, is it a mystery?
Is it a black comedy? Is it a mystery? Is it a thriller?
Yeah.
And it has all those aspects. So I think that might be one of the things that contributes to your antipathy toward a performance.
Yeah. Well, I find that one of the things that's interesting about it is that I haven't figured it out yet. But that only works up to a certain point. I mean, two episodes in, that's fine. I'm hoping that at some point it clicks into gear and we're all on the same page and we know what's going on as far as, you know, what kind of show we're watching. Right now, I'm okay with the first two episodes going, I haven't figured this out yet. I mean, not just what is going on, but in terms of, how am I supposed to feel about it? What type of show are we watching? Is it a murder mystery? Is it this? You know, I mean, is it a comedy? Is it a combination of the two? But I think that they need to kind of really narrow that down quickly.
I would argue by the time we get to the midpoint of this season, we need to know what the genre is.
Yes.
I'm going to posit that I'm actually okay with it being more than one thing, as long as they know how to play it. So it kind of goes back to, I'm fine with the tone when anyone else is on screen, including the robot. I'm fine with the changes in the tone. I personally think Rashida Jones is the one who needs to figure out how to play the different tones essentially all at the same time. And we'll see in the next episodes whether she gets more comfortable in that.
All right, well, we need to move on. I think overall we're saying thumbs up. You should watch the show.
Oh, no, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Next up, we're going to talk about The Bear. And this is, we're going to talk episodes 3 and 4. And I broke my own rule and I apologize because I went ahead and watched more episodes of The Bear. I didn't mean to, but it's addictive and sorry. So now I got to recall what happened in 3 and 4. Somebody help me out. Doors is 3, which is they've opened up the restaurant. And so we're just seeing the chaos of the kitchen, right? Is that? No. Doors opens up with Marcus's funeral for his mom. So that's right. The beginning of the episode. And what I thought that was genuinely interesting is how everybody from work all came in and were really supportive of Marcus. And he gave a really beautiful speech for his mom. And it was really great. And then we go back to the kitchen and everything is chaos. And it all stems from Carmi's non-negotiables.
His non-negotiables.
Non-negotiables.
Has caused chaos beyond chaos. And when he said what his non-negotiables were, I was like, dude, those are stupid. And Sydney should have spoken up. Like, Sydney was like, she looked at his list and was like, this list. And she was like trying to kind of discuss it with him. And he was like, they're non-negotiables. I'm not negotiating. And so she's like, all right. And it just created all kinds of chaos the first night or the first episode, just them just trying to serve all the tables and trying to do the turnovers and trying to just, it was bad. It was bad. So,
yeah, well, you could, you know, the thing is they're trying to do the services. And in the meantime, there's just constant fighting and screaming and yelling, going back and forth, and just the hate that is radiating like heat between Richie and Carmi and the people who are eating in the other room. No matter how good the food is, they can feel that tension. Yeah. They can hear the screaming, and it's just, it's affecting how the restaurant is going.
And I think I texted the group when I said that I was like, the world is upside down where I'm on Richie's side and not Carmi's side. Like, well, I'm always on Carmi's side.
When Richie got sent to spend time with Olivia Colman, he learned a lot.
Yep,
and was willing.
And he became a much better person, actually.
Yes, well, a much better, you know, front of house manager, but a much better person. Whereas Carmi seems to be either stuck or regressing, just in terms of being, he's been awful.
Well, the thing is, Sydney usually balances him. Like, the two of them are usually, when Carmi goes off, Sydney's there to pull him back, and they find this even balance. But this season, she's like being tight-lipped. She's not doing what she normally does. She's just letting him just go, and she's sitting there just quietly in her corner. And I'm like, what the heck? What are you doing? And like, the only time she stepped in was when Richie and Carmi were about to come to blows. When they were about to actually get into a fist fight, she stepped in and was like, stop.
Literally steps in between them.
Literally, yes.
And she's like, nope, we're not doing this in the kitchen. But other than that, she hasn't been doing anything. And it's weird. I'm waiting for her, and I know you guys are ahead of me, but I'm waiting for her to explode, because you can't keep all of that in this long without eventually exploding. And you can tell she's just gritting her teeth, and she's letting Carmi just keep losing it, and she's just being quiet in a corner. And I'm like, all right, she's gonna lose it in a minute.
Well, part of it, you know, is that she doesn't really know what her place is in this. It's like Carmi initially said, this is going to be both of ours, you know, we're going to be equals, but then he's been doing absolutely nothing to treat her as an equal. So right. She doesn't know where she stands there's the contract that she's supposed to sign, and she has pointedly not signing it.
Well, I mean, to be fair, he owes this guy that breaks people's legs $800,000. I don't know I would sign that contract either. That's, you know, I'd be like, nah, dude, that's okay. I'm good.
Did that dollar amount increase from the original amount?
Yes.
Okay, so because that's what I haven't seen yet.
Because of the renovation.
They basically took it from being a beef shop to a high class four star restaurant.
And it went so, to the same guy for the money.
And they actually still are a sandwich shop. They still have that window in the back.
They still have the sandwich window.
Okay.
So they're, they're a floor wax and a dessert topping. They're doing both.
Classic SNL kids, look it up.
But yeah, so it's just like, so they owe all that money. And he's like, I want you to be my partner, sign this contract. I'm like, nah, dude, I'm not signing a contract.
She's being wise and cautious.
Yes, she is. I agree. And she needs to speak up and be like, no, I'm not signing this contract and putting myself in debt. Half of this debt. No, I'm not doing that.
And remember also, she's, I'm pretty sure that this has happened so far, but she's been approached by one of her coworkers.
No, I don't think so. Nope.
In the subway?
No. Oh, yes, that did happen. And he said he loved her food.
He loved her food, and he wanted to talk to her about an arrangement. Yes.
But yeah, and so she's got, basically, I think the contract is a bad deal for her. And I think instinctually she knows that too. And the way he treats her, like you said, he's not treating her like a partner. So if she signs the contract, she's taking the debt, but she's not really being a partner. And it's a bad deal. It's a bad deal. She should still move out of the apartment with her dad, though. So, like, I get her doing that part.
I think it's interesting that so many other people are encouraging her to sign the contract, too. Which, I don't know about you, but, you know, the more that happens, the more suspicious I'd get.
Yeah, I'm like, why y'all want me to sign this contract? Why, like, and she hasn't gotten a lawyer to read it. She should get a lawyer to read that contract, you know? Yeah. She's just been avoiding looking at it. And I think that there's a lot of other things that are happening to make her avoid looking at it. But I would have just been like, hey, I'm getting my lawyer to look at it and leave me alone. But yeah, the what happened in 4? Because that was, Doors was 3. What was 4 before we wrap this up? Because I can't.
That was Violet. And
that was when Marcus sees that flower, that one single flower growing outside his mom's house. And he's like, that's her favorite flower. And he takes the picture. But I don't remember what else happens in that episode. But it basically, my point is, the way that the show is going, it's got some really good stuff, but Carmi is not in a, he's letting his trauma from
everything,
all his other jobs that he's had before, really affect the person he is now. He's just this big anxiety bomb, and he's letting all of that affect everything, and he has to be the leader. He has to be the one that looks like he's in control and knows what he's doing, and I have zero confidence in him right now. So anyway,
well, you know, the problem is that first of all, he comes from a really dysfunctional family. Well, and remember how his brother dealt with stress. I mean, I think he's as douchey as he's acting right now, and as easy as it is to get angry at him because he's treating people terribly around him, I do wonder if he's, you know, the ultimate thing is that he's headed for a nervous breakdown, and how that's going to play out, because he's just ready to explode.
He's too strong. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, alternatively, if he gets a Japanese companion robot, it may help him to deal with his anxiety. That's what I'd recommend.
If it doesn't beat him to death with a chair.
Barring that.
Or a rolling pin.
All right, well, let's wrap this up. So far this season, I'm enjoying the season, even though I'm not enjoying Carmi as much as I normally do. And I am really thankful, at least at this point, they're not shoving his relationship with Claire down my throat, because I never thought they were a good couple.
We got to give a shout out. This is the episode with Josh Hartnett as Richie's wife's soon-to-be new husband.
Oh, that's right.
And I thought that was interesting. I'm glad they didn't vilify the new husband or the soon-to-be new husband.
No, he's a nice guy.
He seemed like a sweet guy.
I didn't even realize that was Josh Hartnett, to everybody's like, oh, it was good to see Josh Hartnett again. But I really liked the thing where his ex had told the daughter, daddy's lonely.
Yes.
And that kind of puts him in a different frame of mind. I got Evan Moss Bachrach. The dude, I've liked him since The Punisher, But man, he has just given this character so many interesting levels. And the
Layers.
fact that
Yeah.
we start season one with the two kind of switched in who we're supposed to like and who we don't. And by this point in season three, we're flipped.
Right.
Yeah.
So
All right,
kudos to both of them.
let's wrap this up. Let's wrap this up. So if you guys have any questions or comments, you can leave them at tvcampfire@gmail.com, follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, and listen to us on YouTube, iTunes, and 6 Degrees of Geek. And we'll talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.